Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the political drama underway in Argentina, where the country's top prosecutor was murdered hours before he was to appear before the Congress to reveal a government cover-up of Iran's role in the 1994 bombing of a Jewish center in Buenos Aires, in which 85 people died. Peter Hakim, President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue, joins us to discuss the bizarre reversal of Argentina's President, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who first claimed the prosecutor's death was suicide, but is now saying it was not, even though the prosecutor was charging that she was involved in a plot to cover up Iran's role in the bombing. Then we'll examine the European Central Bank's infusion of 1.1 trillion euros into the ailing eurozone economies with quantitative easing similar to what the Federal Reserve has done to revive the US economy. Joining us from London is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, a fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London and the director of the Financial Markets Program at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. We will discuss the connection between Europe's economic slump and the rise of right-wing parties, and the report by Oxfam released on the eve of the gathering of the global elite now underway in Davos, Switzerland, that finds more than half of global wealth is controlled by 1% of the world's population. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Brenner, a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh and a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. We will discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Obama's Epiphany, and Obama's State of the Union speech that Michael Brenner argues is 6 years and three elections too late, and the gap between the president's rhetoric and the current political realities. And joining us now is Peter Hakim, who is President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. Previously, he was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and worked for the Ford Foundation in both New York and Latin America. And he has held positions in the Council on Competitiveness, the Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, Partners for Democratic Change, and Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Hakim.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of this political scandal erupting in Argentina, where Argentina's leading prosecutor was found dead just on the eve of when he was about to give testimony to the Argentinian Congress? Literally hours before that, he was found dead. Initially, it was ruled a suicide. And now the president of Argentina is saying it's not a suicide, even though the prosecutor himself is implicating her in a cover-up of the bombing of the Jewish center in Buenos Aires back in 1994 that killed 85 people and was allegedly conducted by the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group.
Well, let me just say this makes Shakespeare's plots rather simple. This is just a very complex, nasty situation that I think is probably the most serious Argentine political crisis in a couple of decades, even worse than when you had the economic collapse. This is really showing basically institutions of the country that are working against one another. It's hard to have confidence in almost any institution now to trust. The thing was, Cristina Fernandez, the president, is actually her accusation is that Nisman was being the prosecutor who was shot was being involved in a conspiracy plot, that someone had basically set him up so that he would attack the government, was feeding him false information. He used that information to bring the charges against President Fernandez, and now she's saying that all that was trumped up to really undermine her government, and this murder of Nisman is just one more part of that conspiracy against her government. Now, I don't know where you can find that outside of a good dose of fiction.
Well, specifically, she's saying that the so-called intelligence operatives that Neesman, the prosecutor, spoke with, who allegedly provided evidence of the government's cover-up of Iranian involvement in the 1994 bombing of the Jewish Center, that they were, in fact, posing as intelligence officers. So is it possible that, it was the Hezbollah killed him, and they'd have an interest in killing him?
It's just sort of very bizarre, like I say, and sort of really calls into question. In other words, Neesman was a pretty highly regarded prosecutor, sort of a man of honest and intelligent and completely committed to this case. The Jewish community in Argentina, which of course had suffered most from the bombing, had great confidence in him in getting to the truth. And but I think this is all going to be unraveling for some time now. You know, the great difficulty when you're dealing with intelligence agencies, what's truth, what's fiction, who's on which side, is often very difficult. There was a certain logic to Neesman's accusations against the president and her foreign minister. Of course, if an intelligence service was involved, they could have manipulated the facts as well. There was just an awful lot of evidence, which is now in the public domain. I mean, it's been published that he had put together. I guess the end question is who benefits from his death, who gets hurt, and it's just very hard to sort through. But one thing is very, very clear. We'd guess that the Argentines, whatever general trust they had in their government to date, has been sorely undercut by this. I mean, there was enough reason for Argentines to be unhappy with their government, distrustful of their government, but now this is sort of raises the stakes just beyond anything that one can sort of compare it with.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Hickim, who's a president emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue, and previously his vice president of the Inter-American Foundation.
You know, Ian, I think you also, the thing to remember is that this is an investigation that's been going on since 1994. It's over 10 years, and 85 people were killed in that. That there were at times accusations against a former Argentine president for being too close to Iran, and this has all been working its way through, and like I say, it has to really undermine any confidence that Argentines will have in their government. Some 70% of Argentines now believe that this was a murder. They don't attribute it to anyone yet, but it's going to be very hard over the next months. The politics of Argentina and the economics, Argentina is in the middle of an economic slump that's going to exact its toll as well. So we're going into a rather difficult territory now.
Well, you mentioned the previous president, Carlos Menem, who was a very controversial figure surrounded by all kinds of scandals.
Right.
And he was a kind of a minor kleptocrat, I think, to put it fairly. But you would think, though, that given what the prosecutor was working on was the link between the reason that they alleged this cover-up of the Iranian and Hezbollah involvement in the bombing of the Jewish Center in 1994 in Buenos Aires, is that Argentina made a deal to sell wheat in exchange for Iranian oil. You'd think that there'd be some fingerprints, some evidence of that. You know, those kind of deals are impossible to hide, aren't they?
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, I haven't seen there's pages and pages, hundreds of pages of evidence that has been made public in Argentina, and it's going to start leaking, you know, not leaking because it's already public, but be publicly printed and all. But and apparently there is a good deal that would substantiate the kind of accusation that Nisman, the prosecutor, was making against the president. There's no question that this is not a small amount of evidence and a lot of conjecture. This is really a sort of, they have emails and telephone calls and talks with Interpol, etc., which, like I say, this is not proof of anything, but it certainly is. There is a large pile of evidence. It's not something that sort of came out of the ether by this prosecutor.
Well, the architect, from my understanding, and a lot of people have looked into this, both here in U.S. intelligence, even the U.N. looked into it as well, this infamous Hezbollah military leader, Imad Mughniyeh,
right,
whose son was just killed on the Golan Heights by an Israeli drone strike. There seems to be a lot of evidence that Mughniyeh was the architect of that bombing. So it's surprising to me that there would be any need for denial. Where do you think the smoking gun lies? Is this...
Well, I think it is, from what I gather from the prosecutor's accusations against the president, my understanding is that Argentina was going through a very rocky, and we're seeing the results of a very rocky economic period, and they're cut off from international loans because they were in default or near default, and manipulating economic data within in Argentina, and having a number of battles with the IMF and a number of other, and that they were in, let's say, difficult economic straits. They wanted access to Iranian oil, and they came up with some idea that they, by protecting some high-level Iranians, I don't know if you could have protected the architect or not, but a number of high-level Iranian government officials, that, but apparently this never really quite worked its way out. In other words, I don't think there was the sale of oil to Argentina. Argentina at that period also benefited from a hugely rising price of commodities, their wheat and other agricultural commodities. So Argentina was seeing itself emerge from its economic problems. It probably became less important. But then Argentina negotiated the creation of a commission with Iran. It was a joint Iranian-Argentine commission that was supposed to look into, to investigate the Amia bombing, the bombing of this Jewish social center. And this was immediately, it was widely criticized in the Jewish community in Argentina, was seen as a way to hide the truth rather than get at the truth. The Argentine government said no, only by sort of finding a way to collaborate with the Iranians could we possibly get at the truth. There was a lot of disagreement about what that commission meant, whether the Argentines simply wanted the whole thing swept under the rug, whether the Iranians were making some deals for oil. All that, at least some part of that, is in the papers that the prosecutor has produced. But it's just very hard to sort this out. And, you know, when you have intelligence services involved, it may not be the government. It may be the intelligence services. Maybe there certainly could have been communications between the Iranians who were involved in the crime against the Jewish center and Argentine intelligence officers. All this is, at this point, is very murky. Word sorted is used a lot, and I think it's going to take a while before it gets sorted out, and I would hope that there would be some kind of international commission that might be established with some people of, you know, that whose reputation is very strong at this point. I think you need to get somebody who, you know, really with what I guess they call impeachable qualifications and reputation to lead something like this to make sure that the results have some credibility. This is a Warren Commission kind of initiative, and I don't think the Argentine government can quite put it together in a way that will satisfy anybody who is the least bit skeptical.
Well, it's clear that the entire Argentine population is skeptical, and that's probably why the president, in first saying that it was suicide, the death of the chief prosecutor, and then reversing herself and now saying that, you know, first saying that it wasn't suicide and then reversing herself saying it was suicide.
Right.
She's just following public opinion, I imagine.
And from what I gather, there seems to be a little bit of surprise within her own advisors that of, you know, what it is that she's trying to achieve right now and what are they, where is she getting the facts and how is this all coming together and why, you know, it's very rare that a president sort of comes out so strongly and then refutes herself and writes a very long letter and which has, and this will be, I can assure you, a Broadway play or a very sort of best-selling book at some point.
So what does this say about the Jewish community in Argentina, given that they were the victims of this 1994 bombing and there were also a number of prominent Jewish leaders, particularly Jacobo Timmerman, were persecuted by the military junta during the period of the Dirty War. So Have they been sort of decimated? Why don't they have sufficient influence to close this case, since most of the world seems to recognize that it was done by Mugnia, the Hezbollah military leader who was killed in Damascus in 2008?
Well, I mean, my guess is, I mean, I can't tell you precisely, but number one is that clearly whatever authority, power, influence the Jewish community can exercise in Argentina, I think it is considerable. There are other groups that also have considerable influence, including the intelligence services, including sort of members of the government and all. And so I think that there is just a lot of pulling and tugging and a great deal of skepticism within Argentina itself about almost everything and a lack of real confidence, trust in institutions. So that, in other words, one of the culprits, according to, as I gather, President Fernandez, was Argentina's leading newspaper, which has been in a virtual constant battle since she was inaugurated president with her. So,
but what's she accusing the newspaper of?
I thought that there was a sentence or two in something she said or wrote to essentially say that the Clarín was clearly involved in this or clearly behind it.
Behind what?
Behind this sort of multi-layered conspiracy.
I see. Well, she said some wacky things of late in any case. Some people have wondered about her mental state.
Well, that's true, and her health is not as good as it might be. But like I say, I think to sort this out, it would be very hard if they don't bring in somebody from outside that really has a impeccable reputation. And who exactly that might be, it's going to be very hard to find just the right person for that, because people are just so suspicious about virtually everything that goes on in the country.
Well, Peter Heckema, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. And again, I've been speaking with Peter Hakim, who's President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. Previously, he was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and worked for the Ford Foundation in both New York and Latin America, and has been on the advisory boards of the Council for Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, Partners for Democratic Change, and Human Rights Watch. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the infusion of 1.1 trillion euros into the ailing eurozone economies.
Makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and is the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
It's very good to be here with you.
And the European Central Bank is now injecting 1.1 trillion euros into the ailing eurozone economies. This is the same as what was called over here with the Fed quantitative easing. Is this likely to work?
I think it's a very important step. It worked partially in the United States, and it's a good thing, particularly because we're beginning to have a problem of deflation. Prices actually went down in December of last year. And, of course, growth is terribly anemic. We have hardly any growth last year, even in Germany, which is our strongest economy, and very high levels of unemployment, about double in the eurozone what you have in the United States. So we're in bad shape. And I think we need actually four kinds of measures. And the first one of these is this quantitative easing that Draghi has announced today, which is, I think, very positive. But not on it, on its own, I don't think it can crack the problem. I think we need a fiscal response, a more expansionary fiscal policy, an income policy, higher wages, particularly in the surplus countries like Germany. And we need a direct boost to investment through mechanisms like the European Investment Bank. So we need to walk on four pillars or four legs. And so we now have in place a very important first leg, but we need the other three.
And how does this affect the situation in Greece, where the upcoming election is expected to go to Syriza, and there's a possibility that they'll pull out of the eurozone? Although this is what the leader of Syriza, like Tsipras, has been saying, is that they want a QE, quantitative easing. So is this likely to change that calculus and perhaps Greece won't drop out of the eurozone?
Well, the first point is I would like to make is that Syriza has said very clearly that they do not want to pull out of the eurozone. They want to renegotiate the deal that they have. They want less austerity. And they would like to have more debt relief and more new money. And, I mean, there is some risk that if there is a confrontation between them and the creditors, that this could have a negative outcome. But they have emphasized very strongly that they do not want to pull out of the eurozone, because also the majority of the Greek people in surveys say they want to stay in. Curiously, it's the parties of the extreme right, like Madame Le Pen in France, who wants to pull out of the eurozone, like UKIP in the UK, which wants to pull out even further, wants to go out of the EU. So Syriza wants a big renegotiation. They want, basically, they want space to grow. And I think they have quite a good case, although I think they have to moderate their request. I mean, I think this will make things easier, although it seems that in the conditions that, that Mario Draghi has put, it's not automatic that they will get the benefits of quantitative easing were they to pull out of an IMF EU program. So they will need to be very, I think, delicate negotiations about that. But it certainly changes the context. Certainly in the short term, I think this sort of European quantitative easing, following in the footsteps of American ones and Japanese and British ones, would seem to facilitate the situation, both in terms of facilitating a little bit more credit, I think, to enterprises, and avoiding the risk of deflation. Because deflation is very bad. If you're in a debt crisis and prices are going down, your debt burden automatically goes up. So this will also help Greece indirectly.
Well, of course, people, when they talk about deflation, refer to the period of stagnation, the last decade in Japan. But in the President's State of the Union a few nights ago, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, there was a certain triumphalism in what President Obama was saying, that America's back, the engines are all running, and we're doing better than the rest of the world, and most of the rest of the world is a basket case. Of course, he didn't say that, you know, jobs are back, but wages are not back. But what is your understanding of why America is relatively better off in terms of its economic growth and prospects than Europe and Japan?
Well, I think that, triumphalism is exaggerated, but looking at the U.S. from Europe, it looks pretty good. And I think it has been a mixture precisely of quantitative easing on the monetary side, and especially initially, quite a dynamic fiscal policy. So there was quite a lot of deficit spending. There was a lot of investment spending by the government. And, of course, you have other factors like this fracking, which has turned the United States basically into a net oil exporter from having been a big oil importer. So you have this advantage. But I think in the case of Europe, there has been this combination of austerity through all these different mechanisms, tight monetary policy, fiscal consolidation at, on a brutal level in the deficit countries like Greece. So big cuts in government spending, but also fiscal consolidation in the surplus countries. I mean, you have a country like Germany, which has a 7% current account surplus, 7%, one of the largest ever, and it is still tightening its fiscal belt. It doesn't make any sense. And also real wages in countries like Greece have fallen by, say, about a third, pensions and real wages. So what more Keynesian economists think is we should have less fiscal consolidation in the southern Eurozone, countries like Greece, but also Spain and Ireland. But also we should have far less fiscal consolidation, particularly on the investment side, in Germany, because they have all the fiscal space they need. They can borrow so cheaply. And finally, they should increase wages more, because with the euro falling, they can raise wages in Germany and still remain competitive. So if you follow a policy that will lead to more aggregate demand, the whole eurozone region can grow more, which is exactly what has happened in the United States.
So, Stephanie, is there a link then between the rise of right-wing parties in France, Le Pen, in Hungary, which is led by a right-winger, and there's even more right-wing parties to the right of him, and then you've got Nigel Farage and UKIP in the UK that looks like they're going to do quite well in the upcoming elections? Is there a connection between the rise of these right-wing neo-fascist parties and the economic malaise in Europe?
I think you're quite right to make that link, because although there are other causes, I think it's a very important link, because people feel that the current politicians are not delivering. Current politicians in Greece, in France, in Spain, in the UK, actually, the economic situation is relatively better. But in countries like France and Greece, the situation is very bad, in Spain. And people feel disaffected that they're not getting what they want, and they turn to these populist politicians who give them extremely simplistic recipes and who tend to just blame foreigners for all the problems. And it's quite scary because we've been here in Europe before. I mean, this was the rise of fascism in the 30s, which came not, as the Germans think, only because of hyperinflation, of which they're so afraid, but because of the high level of unemployment. I mean, if you think that in Spain and in Greece, over 50% of young people are unemployed, so you can understand why people turn to extremist parties. And in a way, although it may be a bit exaggerated, Syriza is, I think, far less dangerous than, say, Golden Dawn, which is an extreme right-wing party in Greece, which luckily is not too big. But Madame Le Pen, who could even win the presidency in France, is really very scary. So it is exactly this inability of the economic policies to deliver growth and employment. And I think that's why it's so important to change the policies. And in that sense, I think today is a good day for Europe and for the Eurozone, because we've started finally to take the step that countries like the United States and the United Kingdom have been following for some years, and that a lot of economists have been calling for. It's not a perfect measure because it has problems down the road. It may contribute to bubbles, but it will start laying a base, I think, for more sustained growth, particularly if it's accompanied by more expansionary fiscal policies, by more expansionary wages, and a new program of investment, which has also been launched by European Commission President Juncker. So if there is some kind of hopeful turning of the policies.
So just a few days ago, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, the British charity group Oxfam issued a report saying that 1% of the global elite, the 1%, own more wealth than the rest of us. Extraordinary statistic. So when you talk about the link between right-wing populism and economic malaise, there is, of course, a justification in a broader sense for a populist revolt against that appalling statistic that 1%, the 1% control more wealth in the world than the 99%.
But there is, of course, a rationale. But for example, Nigel Farage, if you look at his economic policies, they're very right-wing, and they would, if anything, make income distribution even worse. Whereas if you have more progressive policies, for example, to increase real wages, to increase jobs, this will mean that you will have more growth, because poorer people, working class people, will spend a higher proportion of the income, and so this will be good for growth, but it will also be good for income distribution, and it will take away the challenge of the extreme right. So if you like, business people and so on were actually less greedy in some ways and captured less of the wealth, and they allowed real wages went up and governments pursued these policies, obviously within reason because you have to remain competitive, then there will be more aggregate demand, there will be more jobs. And because Europe trades so much, European countries trade so much with each other, the more you do it in different countries, they will all benefit.
Well, there is this new movement of so-called inclusive capitalism, which was mentioned recently by the head of the Bank of England, the Canadian who heads up the Bank of England, the notion that capitalism needs to be reformed, that it is not, it's concentrating too much wealth at the top and not providing enough wealth for the rest of us, even harking back, I guess, to Henry Ford's idea that you have to pay your workers enough to buy your Model T Ford.
Exactly.
And there was echoes of that in President Obama's State of the Union speech in terms of taxing the 1% of the 1% in terms of capital gains and loopholes in trusts that pass on billions and billions to the heirs of billionaires. So do you see this as a growing movement, this so-called inclusive capitalist movement?
I think it is. And we have people like, of course, even the institutions like the International Monetary Fund, who is certainly no lefty institution, has started to talk in a very articulate way about income distribution. Thomas Piketty has become a sort of rock star best-selling economist because he has done some very interesting work, research, but also because he has precisely touched on this key problem. So I think there is quite a strong movement, but we have to see whether governments can deliver the policies that are needed, like increasing taxes and using that to fund programs that will generate jobs and will allow for higher wages as well. So I think we have the instruments. We know what to do. I think weakening the excessive power of finance is also important because, for example, in the 0.1%, who are the absolutely richest, these billionaires that you're talking about, almost 20% of them work in the financial sector. So it is the excessive profits and the excessive remuneration in the financial sector which contributes in a major way to explain this very, very bad, very skewed income distribution. So we need to, I think it's a very positive thing that attention is being drawn to this and that hopefully policies in this direction will be emerging quickly. And I think we need to do both at the same time. We need to recover growth, certainly in the Eurozone, continue dynamic growth in the U.S. and in the rest of the world, and at the same time have, as you say, and as the Governor of the Bank of England said, a more inclusive growth.
Well, of course, the Oxfam study came out on the eve of Davos, where a lot of billionaires sit around in hot tubs looking out at the Swiss Alps and discussing the fate of the world. Given that we have a very reactionary Republican House and Senate now, who basically are in the pocket of the 1%, and then Cameron, of course, represents the Conservatives, and you were just pointing out that these emerging right-wing parties in Europe would even exacerbate the income disparity because, just like Hitler, they take care of the wealthy and screw everybody else. So where is that other, those other voices going to come? Where is the populist movement on the left?
Well, for example, it's interesting because people like Syriza, of course, are emphasizing measures that would favor more the poorer people. They want to increase wages. They want to give free health to people who are very poor at the moment as a result of the crisis. You have a third of decline in wages and pensions in Greece. You have in Spain, not only the traditional social democrats are doing well in the polls, but there's also a new very left-wing party called Podemos, which is to the left of the traditional socialists, social democrats. And together they will probably form the next government, or even Podemos on its own. In Italy, although very moderate, you have the center-left, the Partito Democratico, also leading the government. So you have in a number of countries, and possibly in the United Kingdom, in the end, the Labour Party will win, which is making a lot of emphasis on improving what they call the living wage and the living conditions of ordinary people. So you have some hope, I think. I think in Europe and Latin America, you also have parties of the center-left, like in Chile, in Brazil, and so on, who have been pursuing policies of improving income distribution. In fact, in Brazil, income distribution has improved quite significantly from very concentrated levels. So you have some areas of hope. I mean, clearly the Republicans controlling the Congress is very bad news.
Well, on that note of bad news, which we're all only too well aware of here, I thank you so much for joining us from London, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
Thank you. you very much. And maybe we can also have some more optimistic news in the future.
I sure hope so. And again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who's Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and the Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and is the co-editor with Joseph Stiglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into whether Obama's State of the Union speech was 6 years and three elections too late.
And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done, for you and your children. Yeah, you already know how this will end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Brenner, a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a contributor to research and consulting projects on Euro-American security and economic issues. A consultant to the United States Department of Defense and State, he's the author of numerous books, including, most recently, Towards a More Independent Europe. His latest article at the Huffington Post is Obama's Epiphany. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Brenner.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And you characterized the State of the Union speech that we just heard a couple of nights ago as sort of confirming the gap between the virtual and the actual and confirming the fact that it's unbridgeable and essentially that it was an exercise in rhetoric given the current political realities. But there was, I think, you know, it sort of reminded me of, I see it as a great American tragedy, actually, that this is somebody that actually probably tried to do the best he could and was genuinely bipartisan in his outlook. I've spoken to people who work with him at Harvard, and he'd love to go to those weekend-long seminars where the head of the Christian Coalition would be sitting down next to a union leader, and they'd all have these sort of bipartisan embraces and trying to work on problems together. And then it seems to me that he genuinely believed in or at least tried that approach and finally has come to the conclusion, obviously 6 years too late, that you can't work with these people. I mean, watching the contempt, the stony-faced contempt that these people on the Republican side have towards this man, they hate him so much that they'll bring down America just to bring him down.
That's true. That's true. But let's go back to, one of the classical and oldest political axioms. In order to be successful in any kind of political exchange, any sort of political transaction, whether it involves conflict in varying degrees or not, is one, you have to know yourself. The other is you have to know the other party or your opponent. See, my sense is that Barack Obama has been ambivalent, indeed, about his own purposes and objectives, and he's been utterly dense in terms of understanding, as you correctly sort of put it, in terms of the ruthlessness of the Republicans in pushing for their own reactionary agenda and for undermining or trying to undermine the legitimacy of the Obama presidency. And I think by temperament also, he is a compromiser. He's someone inclined to stick to the middle of the road. And as a consequence of all of these traits, he has presided over, is a failed presidency, certainly a failed presidency by the measure of the Democratic Party and the interests that they represent.
Well, I see a comparison with what happened with the first few years of Bill Clinton. He swept in with the trifecta, controlling the presidency. The Democrats had the presidency, the House and the Senate from 92 to 94, and he didn't get a lot done. And most of the problems he had was with his own Democratic Party and the Mandarins, the Democratic Mandarins in the Senate and the powerful House members basically frustrated him. And I recall when Obama came in there with this disastrous economy in free fall. And perhaps you can argue that he should have let it fall like Roosevelt did when Hoover was begging him to join in before FDR took office as the economy tanked in the Great Depression. So, he had a lot of trouble from the Democratic side. And is it a part of the reality of Washington that we basically have two conservative parties?
Well, I think that's true, but I don't think that was a handicap for Obama, because I think his own leanings, frankly, are rather conservative. If you look at Obama's sort of career, and this goes back, way back, you can say it goes back to his Harvard days, if you actually look at the campaign he ran to get himself selected as editor of the Harvard Law Review, is that he uses liberal or progressive imagery, rhetoric, themes, etc., to win positions of authority. But then when he has them, his behavior is far more conservative. I think the Obama sort of record over the past 6 years, not only in what he has achieved or not achieved, but in what he's proposed, is very much that of what used to be called a moderate Republican or a Rockefeller Republican. Of course, a breed that is now extinct. So as a consequence, I mean, the country's and I think this has both accelerated a process of devolution within the Democratic Party, whereby the whole party leadership, although not its voters, have been trending in the same direction. And as a consequence, I think in many respects, certainly as regard to economic policy, certainly as regard to most economic issues, you see a leaning towards the right and contests being run between middle of the roaders and the far right, which has now is committed to a reactionary agenda, or you could call it the Tea Party right, which now dominates and exercises a veto over what the Republican leadership does.
So do we basically, anybody on the left or anybody that's progressive in this country, I suppose, given the political realities, cling to the idea that there's still a kind of left? And by contrast, the right is so extreme that you basically give somebody a pass. Because frankly, the way I see it is that the Democrats only have the prospect of winning the presidency. And if the Republicans got the trifecta and controlled all branches of government, and they certainly control the judiciary as well, then I think the oligarchs would basically, you know, they'd own everything that's not already taken, you know?
Well, I think what happens is in America, that is an implicit plutocracy, becomes an explicit sort of plutocracy. I mean, we are really, as I see it, at a turning point in American sort of political history. The prevailing sort of political philosophy and the basis for a wide consensus, although not a unanimous one, which supported or came or reconciled itself with the innovations of the New Deal, that lasted right through the 1970s. And it's been gradually modified and now retracted, beginning in the Reagan years. And we're really on the brink of shifting the locus of not just American politics, but of American government and public policy back to the 1920s. I mean, that is the very clear and stated, you know, objective of the Republicans in Congress. And what's been added to that, even sort of more radical ideas in regard to some of the so-called sort of social issues that, you know, whether it's gun control, environmental sort of protections, abortion, gay rights, et cetera. Oddly, it's on those issues in which there is still a difference between the National Democratic Party and the National Republican Party. I think another fact to throw into the mix is that if you look at the opinion surveys as to where Americans stand on the issues, on the social issues I just mentioned, they're closer to the Democrats than the Republicans. And on the economic issues, they are well to the left of where the Obama administration and the congressional leadership has been. As a consequence, you have a significant slice of the American electorate that is de facto been disenfranchised. And I think that has expressed itself in declining turnouts in the last election last year, last federal national election, turnouts were the lowest they had been since World War II, when people didn't vote because they were fighting in Europe and the Pacific. A lot of people are simply turned off by politics because neither party promises to represent them and their interests.
And, of course, the tragic trend here is that as fewer people vote, more money pours in. So it's reductio absurdum is that at the end of the day we'll have one person voting and the billionaires spending zillions just to get a handful of votes.
Sure, it becomes that much more manipulable.
Right.
Because the question which is looming there, saying if you have a significant segment of the population which is disaffected, then all the laws of democratic electoral politics say that there will be political entrepreneurs who will try to exploit that. In other words, people who will throw their hats into the ring, whether it's a state senatorial, a gubernatorial election, or a presidential one, seeing an opportunity to tap those voters and using it to drive a candidacy. And we don't see that, though. On the Democratic side, where there is a real void in the progressive part of the Democratic Party sort of continuum, they're not represented. There is no one now, even in the wings, who is likely to present him or herself as a candidate. And so you have a Hillary out there sort of all alone, who's fallen silent on all the big issues of the day, and is sort of hoping to get nominated by default.
And, of course, because of this lack of a narrative and this huge vacuum in terms of a narrative on the left, you have people like Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney talking about their compassion for the poor. It's an extraordinary irony, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this points up, of course, another feature of American political life and sort of public discourse, or let's say two features which I think are interlaced. One is the failure of the media, really, to give point and sort of focus and explanation to political debate. I mean, a generation or two ago, you couldn't get away with these shenanigans because the ludicrousness of Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney in claiming that they're now representing the interests of the poor would have been rejected. Not only instinctively by the populace, but the media would focus on it, highlight it, call attention to it. Now they don't. They just sort of present it as neutral news. I think the other element, which is permissive of this, is that the public's attention to public to political matters, their knowledge, and so on, is so thin that you can get away with practically anything, and everyone does it on both sides of the aisle, in the White House and in Congress as well, at the local level and the national level, so that you have an unstructuredness, a diffuseness, an incoherence to American political sort of discourse, which allows the most sort of extraordinary things to occur, such as what you just mentioned. And, of course, specifically, you know, since inequality is a word that's in the wind, everyone will pick it up and sees men to use it, because there is nobody who is really defining it, explaining it, and translating it into specific programs and a practical, concrete political platform. If you had a Democrat doing that, and then challenging the symbolic gestures of a Bush or Romney, you would have far better definition and a far higher level of understanding of what's at stake than you do now.
Well, just in closing, Michael Brenner, as more money pours in our money-driven politics and fewer people vote, it's worth noting that most of the money that comes from the special interest to the candidates, and basically we've turned our politicians into telemarketers, that money is then transferred to the big media companies. So they basically have an interest in the process, not in the results. And that seems to be why we have a kind of game show democracy.
Well, exactly. I mean, American politics has become sort of celebrity politics. It's covered almost exactly the same way that the Academy Awards are covered. American Idol is covered, whatever. The full consequence and significance of political life, of elections, of political dialogue is diluted and is lost, quite frankly. And yes, money and commercial interest drives a lot of this, but there are also those who benefit from it insofar as it perpetuates the status quo and really doesn't allow for any serious challenge from those who might want to change it. The only challenge we've had is really from the radical reactionary right with the emergence of the Tea Party. But one last word on that. I think the Tea Party really serves as the shock troops for conservative sort of interests, particularly corporate interests in the United States. And so then that effect is to accentuate this swing towards a old republic, old style conservative Republican view of and ways of looking at public issues.
Well, Michael Brenner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Brenner, who's a professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a contributor to research and consulting projects on Euro-American security and economic issues. A consultant to the United States Department of Defense and State, he's the author of numerous books, including most recently, Towards a More Independent Europe. His latest article at the Huffington Post is Obama's Epiphany. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.